Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Good morning.
Hello. Welcome.
Come on in. Grab a seat. Or stay standing if you prefer. And Jesse, this is Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, the campus community radio station all the way up here on Burnaby Mountain at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast on the unceded and ancestral territory of the Halkomelem and Squamish-speaking peoples, who are the original storytellers of these lands. And I'm very honored and proud to be able to continue on some form of oral storytelling here on the radio. I'm very grateful to be able to do it here in Burnaby as well. So on today's show, we have a bunch of stuff. I think four different pieces, two by me and two by Danny, are what's loaded up at the moment. I think Danny's also going to come in and set up one of those pieces when the time arises. But as usual, we are going to start with a little bit of local music. We're going back to the Well of the Houseplants. I have played them, earlier this week on Tuesday. I'm pretty sure I played them on last Thursday, maybe even the Tuesday, last Tuesday. I played them on my show, the Vancouver Mixtape. I really like this new record, Into Equilibrium by the Houseplants, and it's now been added to the CJSF playlist. So I got to give it another play, get those numbers up for the charts. We are going to hear the title track off the new record by the Houseplants. This is Into Equilibrium.
In a world that
Welcome back to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. That was Into Equilibrium by the Houseplants from their new record of the same name. And next, I'm going to hear a piece that I put together. I attended, not this past Friday, but the one before, an event here at Simon Fraser University put on by the Department of Archaeology and the Department of Indigenous Studies. And facilitated by Moontide Reconciliation, they did a experiential workshop called the Blanket Exercise. I spoke with Meredith on, was that a Tuesday show or a Thursday show? A couple weeks ago, previewing the event and encouraging you to come and participate. I went and it was very good. It was heavy. As you might imagine, an exercise walking you through the history of colonization and colonialism in Canada might be. But it was very moving and very educational and allowed me to engage with some of these topics and, the horrors of colonialism and all these other things in a much different, less intellectual and more, well, experiential, more empathetic way, I think. So we're going to hear just my report on that right now.
You guys are three indigenous people. You guys can walk Turtle Island here, talk to your friends.
Hello, neighbors.
During a workshop at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia, participants walk through the history of colonization in what is now Canada, providing an experiential learning opportunity for all involved.
Here today is the northern part of what we now know as North America, before the arrival of the Europeans. By standing on these blankets, you represent the indigenous people, the people who have been here since time immemorial, long before the arrival of the Europeans. This land was our home to millions of First Nations people, and Inuit have been living here.
Telling history through an Indigenous perspective, the Kairos Blanket Exercise invites participants to witness, experience, and immerse themselves in the devastating impacts of European colonization on the original inhabitants of this continent.
You represent the First Nations which were divided when the border between the United States and British Dominion of Canada was created. This border divides communities and cuts us off from each other.
You will be glued to separate blankets to represent the creation of this border. If you are part of the same family or community, it doesn't matter. Move now.
So with people close to one another, yes. Yeah.
The event was facilitated by Moontide Reconciliation, with Lana Arnold taking the lead.
I'm from Upper Nicola Band in Merritt. From my dad's side, I'm from Saskatchewan Standing Buffalo Reserve. The blanket exercise goes over 500 years of history from the Indigenous eyes. We go over MMIWG, residential school, 60 Scoop, and other colonial violence that has happened to our people. And it's from an Indigenous view, so everybody in the room gets to experience from an Indigenous lens and to start to feel like what we're feeling. I think it's really important for people to feel kind of what we experience so they can have a better understanding of where we come from. And that's when I notice they start seeing a change, like they realize, like, now it all makes sense.
Arnold says that beyond providing an opportunity for non-Indigenous participants to engage with the history of colonialism and participate in a small act of reconciliation, delivering the workshops has made a tremendous positive change in her own life.
About a year ago, when my mom, she was a short staff member, so she just threw me in there and said, "You're going to be playing the European, and she's going to be the narrator," and she told me, and I didn't realize, like, I wasn't even in that part of my healing journey yet, and I realized, I was like, "Well, this is more than what I thought it was." I didn't know what to expect when you hear blanket exercise. I was also shocked. I was like, oh, this is what we're doing. So when I started doing the workshop myself, I also started learning about my own culture and everything, the truth. I started realizing the things I've gone through and with trauma and everything, it made me realize where I came from. And I forgave my family and everything that I've experienced.
The workshop is extremely impactful, and participants emerge with a revamped understanding of and empathy for Indigenous people.
Yeah, I've had people, a lot of emotions come out of it, like people cry, or you could tell they just realize like what we're going through. And for me, I don't want people to feel like kind of like pity or sorry. Like, I want people to just have respect for Indigenous people and treat us like humans and acknowledge us. Yeah.
It's a small step on the path to reconciliation, but the blanket exercise presents a unique opportunity to move forward on the long journey.
For me, I hope people take away we're still here, we're resilient, and just to acknowledge us, to enjoy our culture and not look too much in the past. Like, it's important to look in our past, but we want to move forward and in a good way.
Please step off the blanket and join your ancestors in the circle. After these acts of resistance and fearing for your lives, many of you changed your names and moved away, sometimes as far as the United States. Some of you moved back to your First Nations families and joined these communities through adoption processes. Some of you hid or denied your Indigenous heritage altogether. These were the dark times for the Métis. There was a time of persecution and extreme poverty.
From Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia, I'm Jesse Wensloff for CJSF 90.1 FM. This story is made possible by funding from the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative and is available online with stories from across the country at frequencynews.ca. I highly recommend, if you get the chance to participate in the Kairos Blanket exercise, that you do it. I learned a lot, and it was an experience I'm glad I was able to have. We're going to take a quick music break, hear from local rockers Chalcedony, incorporating the baritone guitar, which is always a big fan of, or I'm a big fan of mine. I'm always a big fan of the baritone guitar. And so we're going to hear their new track, Venus Thirst Trap.
Visions get you stoned. Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvitarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. While we are all familiar with our public health guidelines for nutrition and exercise, we may need to start considering public health guidelines for social connection. According to Kiffer Card, an SFU Health Sciences assistant professor and a leader in the creation of new public health guidelines for social connection, social isolation is a public health issue that needs to be considered in the same way that we think about smoking or living a sedentary lifestyle as a determinant of overall health. In order to combat this, he, alongside a network of Canadian experts, developed a national public health guideline for social connection. In collaboration with social connection advocacy nonprofit GenWell and the Canadian Alliance for Social Connection and Health, the guidelines are separated into two lists, one for individuals and one for communities, that can be utilized by policymakers. To learn more about what these guidelines entail, CJSF was joined in conversation by Kiffer Card, who explained the public health value of the guidelines, as well as how they can be best implemented. Please take a listen to our conversation.
Yeah, our guidelines, what we're calling kind of public health guidelines for social connection, are a lot like the food and exercise guidelines or lower risk alcohol use guidelines that Canada has really led the way in developing globally since 1942, when the first food guide was launched. But ours, of course, deal with a new area of public health advice, and that's these social connection guidelines. I think all of us, you know, intuitively know that our relationships are really important, right? If you have a bad relationship, it affects you a lot. You feel the emotional weight of conflict and that sort of thing. And when things are going well, our relationships can be one of our greatest sources of joy. And over the past several decades, dating back to even the 1900s, there was research showing that people like bachelors and war wives and widows suffered profound mental health and physical health consequences, and notably premature death. And so over the years, that evidence has accrued to where now we know that being lonely or socially isolated, not having a supportive network, is as damaging as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. And yet there really hasn't been an effort in public health to address social relationships as a core behavioral determinant of health until now. And that was largely motivated by the COVID-19 pandemic, of course, where all of us collectively got to experience what it was like to be isolated. And that was a big wake-up call for a lot of people. So our guidelines really serve as a reminder for each of us to think about the status of our social relationships, the network, whether we're getting enough diverse social interactions, say with coworkers or friends and family, and whether or not we're really prioritizing that in-person, face-to-face connection, which appears to be really critical in a context and world in which a lot of our interactions are increasingly digital.
You said that a lack of social connection can be as bad as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. That's a very specific comparison. Where is that coming from specifically, if you could speak on that?
Yeah, so that's data from a meta-analysis. There's been a few different studies that have drawn this association to other leading risk factors for health. We find compared to air quality, you know, it's like that's like a maybe a 6% increase. Living in an area with poor air quality is like a 6% increase in risk for premature death. Being obese or, you know, living a sedentary lifestyle, that's like a 20% increase in risk for premature death. When you get to things like loneliness, social isolation, smoking is the number one public health threat that we faced as a society. You know, it's the leading cause of preventative death and has been for a long time. And that effect is about a 40% increase. And that's about what we find with loneliness and social isolation, that between, you know, that kind of pack a day or around that, that being lonely or isolated is associated with a 30 to 50%, depending on the estimate. But those come from large scale meta-analyses and studies looking at huge samples of people.
Okay, thank you. I want to learn a bit about how you specifically got into this sort of research and what prompted you to want to develop these guidelines.
Yeah, so my long-standing work has been in what we call syndemics. And syndemics is really looking at the ways that various epidemics come together to create poor health. And the classic syndemic factors are what we call like substance use, mental health, and sexual risk, and adverse childhood experiences, that those things kind of together really serve as a syndemic. When people experience those, they often experience them together, and they often experience worse health outcomes than if they were doing any one of them alone. And in each of those kind of research areas that I worked in, whether it was substance use or whether it was mental health or whether it was STI risk, and other bloodborne infections, diseases, we always found that people's social relationships was one of the most important predictors of whether they knew how to protect themselves. So the diffusion of that information of risk prevention, whether they had the social and emotional support needed to come out of those experiences. And so eventually I said, well, why don't we actually go upstream? And if it appears to be people's relationships and social environments that's driving their well-being, let's stop focusing on the crises of, HIV, substance use, opioids, and let's actually go upstream and look at how can we actually build healthy families, communities, and friendship networks that can protect people from falling into the traps of those other factors.
One thing I wanted to ask that I was curious about is, so there are two separate guidelines in a sense, like one for individuals and another for communities as a whole. What is the expectation for how these guidelines are going to be implemented?
Yeah, so I think guidelines serve a unique role in public health. They really bring priority and attention to an issue. If you think of when we created the food guide, or when we created exercise guidelines, or even sleep guidelines or alcohol guidelines, there wasn't necessarily a strong evidence base or a strong practice in the community of addressing those things. There weren't like things like after school programs that made sure people, there weren't free lunch programs that made sure people got food. But however, those guidelines said, here's the standard. Here's what a person needs to be healthy. And now let's work together as a system, as communities, as municipalities, to put in places things that will help people achieve those goals. And so we, invest in community centers. We invest in good food programs and food security work. And all of that was really preempted by the first decision to make these a priority. So our guidelines just aren't about berating people to do, oh, here's another thing to get, into your day. You need to socialize in addition to go to the gym and eat healthy and all these other things that we ask people to do. But it's really about mobilizing the public health sector around addressing those kind of fundamental needs and making sure that we equip people, because we know the existing system is not. If you look at, the number of people who say they don't have a best friend over the past several years, that has increased an order of magnitude. People's time that they're spending socializing, loneliness rates are out of control. More people are lonely now than they've ever been on this planet and our whole history. And so if you think about the way systems and structures are structured now, they're obviously not working to build people's relationships. And so the guidelines are to say, we actually need to work on this. We need to start creating that infrastructure and systems of things that allow people to live happy and healthy and connected lives.
The last question that I wanted to ask you is, what do you hope is next for this research or these guidelines for social connection? How do you want, not just individuals, but like local governments or policymakers or, leaders on university campuses to implement them in a sense?
Yeah, I think that's one of the big challenges with a lot of health issues, particularly when we think about public health guidance. If you think of, we give a lot of advice around food and nutrition, exercise, but at the end of the day, large proportions of people are not able to get out and get that 30 minutes of exercise a day. They're not able to put half their plate being greens and fruits and vegetables. And so really thinking about how do we help people, like really getting into that and starting to invest public health research dollars into answering that question of how do we connect people to their communities? How do we help them build authentic and meaningful connections? And what are the fundamental conditions that are required? I think that we still don't know what we can do. We have to start piloting and testing and evaluating things. And that means we have to really understand, where people are at now, and what they would be able and willing to do to improve their social connections and relationships once they understand that social connection is a priority. And so really, we're moving away from an era of just problem identification. As I said, we've known for 40, 50, 60 years that social connection is really a core determinant, a social determinant of health. But yet, we really haven't done the work and research needed to understand what can we actually do about it. Are we destined for this kind of continually socially disconnected society? Or can we reverse the trends on that and turn people back to community and find social cohesion? And how we do that, it's a really tricky question, because big solutions can't just come from the top down, but they also need to start with a change from the bottom up and then meet somewhere in the middle.
So yeah, these guidelines in a sense are almost like a stepping stone towards those conversations and those big decisions.
Yeah, that's our thinking. I think as much of an innovation that these guidelines are in public health to reorient the field of public health towards the social determinants, I think they do represent a major shift in our thinking and how we're addressing public health as a priority. They are only the start. They're not the solution. They're simply an opening salvo for the conversations like this one that we're having now that will undoubtedly point some people to thinking like, maybe I'm not getting as much social connection, or maybe watching that Netflix alone at home, maybe I need to invite somebody over to do that with me. Thinking of those small little steps that we can take, and each of those steps over time, I think, does accumulate, especially at a population level, to really building a society where people are more thoughtful and willing to connect, to get that what they fundamentally need is, we call humans social animals. We fundamentally need social connection. And I hope that the guideline awakens some people to that, and especially awakens policymakers to thinking about how can we make sure our communities don't become, forever polarized and disconnected.
Once again, that was our conversation with SFU Health Sciences Assistant Professor and a lead creator for the Public Health Guidelines for Social Connection, Kiffer Card. To learn more about these guidelines, you can visit socialconnectionguidelines.org. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby.